Spectator is having a flash sale. Get 12 issues of the magazine for just £12, in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Whiskey, completely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale. Be quick, the offer ends on Monday.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Ball, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today was born in Lancashire and grew up in Merseyside. She was the only pupil at her secondary school to get 10 O-levels, and aged 16 she went on to complete an apprenticeship at a car factory. After studying for a degree in business studies at Liverpool John Moores University, she spent the next few decades in the corporate world, rising the ranks of NatWest, MasterCard and Amadeus. In 2015, politics came calling when Baroness Anne Jenkin persuaded her to run as a Conservative candidate. After unsuccessfully contesting St Helens South and Wiston in 2015, she became Director of Women to Win, an organisation co-founded by Theresa May to get more Conservative women elected. In 2017, she entered Parliament, winning the safe seat of Chichester. In the following years, she held a string of junior government positions, backed Theresa May's Brexit deal, and supported Rory Stewart in the 2019 leadership contest. Remember him. In February 2020, she became the Minister for Apprenticeships and Skills. My guest today is Gillian Keegan.
So thank you very much for joining me today, Gillian. And we are recording in the Spectator office, but at a very safe social distance. Now, one of the things on this podcast we like to do, I suppose, as a first question, is ask what I've been told is a leading question, but let's see. Would you describe your childhood as a happy one?
Yeah, definitely. It was a super happy childhood. So there's myself, I'm the eldest. I've got a sister, brother, mum and dad, who are still happily married. I don't know how many years now, 60 odd. And my dad's one of 13, so we're from a massive Liverpool Catholic family. And, you know, I've got tons of cousins, and I guess that created its own environment. I mean, you know, there was no money, but there was a lot of laughs. So, yeah, I love my family. I still go back and see them all the time. They're still the best night out ever.
And as you say, you grew up in Merseyside, which isn't really known for being a Tory stronghold. So was politics something that was discussed much growing up? Did your parents have strong political views?
Parents, definitely not. They never discussed politics. My mum was politically interested, and she's basically a floating voter. She has voted for everybody from the Greens to UKIP. She's done the whole lot. So she's a proper floating voter. Dad never says what he votes. But I guess it wasn't that political. We didn't talk about politics. Nobody talked about politics. But my granddad was a miner. So the miners' strike, when that was happening, I got a lot of his political views then, which, let's just say, he wasn't a huge fan of Margaret Thatcher. Nor was he a fan of Arthur Scargill. He was a Joe Gormley man.
So did you start to have political views when you were growing up, or did it come later in life?
It came as I started work. Well, I suppose I started work at 16, so I was relatively young when I started work. I didn't have strong political views. I suppose if somebody would have asked me, I probably would have thought I was Labour. Everybody was Labour. It was a Labour place, you know. To get to school, I walked past Wilson Road, you know, Lansbury Road, Attlee Road, Hardy Road. The place was pretty steeped in Labour history.
Strong hints of what you might decide.
All the way, yeah. So, you know, I guess, you know, it was only ever Labour, and all my, you know, my grandparents, yeah, I think they'd been activists actually in their day as well. But I'd never really thought about it until I started work. And my first election, I was 19. So I started work at 16 in a car factory in Kirby. And that's when I started to be aware of, well, the unions for a start. It was the 80s, it was Merseyside, it was a car factory. There was a lot of strike action, let's just say. And that's where I started to sort of get more experience and sort of look at it. And, of course, I had Liverpool City Council in the form of Derek Hatton, just, you know, giving me a full example of the world according to militant tendency. So I did have quite a lot of political experiences, you know.
That's interesting, because we had Therese Coffey on this podcast a while ago, and she also had the experience up close what Derek Hatton and militant were doing when she was around Merseyside growing up. And it does seem to have had that effect on a few people, just seeing it made them actually suddenly become much more political than perhaps they would have been otherwise.
It was astonishing. It was like jaw-dropping watching it. I actually met Derek Hatton. It's astonishing. There was a wine bar. They opened a wine bar in Highton, which really was a room in a hotel. It was called Natterjack's, and there was a big opening, and it was the poshest thing that had happened to Heighton, which, let's just say, there wasn't that many sort of swanky venues. Anyway, we go there, and there was a guy and his mate, and they were drinking champagne, and nobody drank champagne then. Nobody. I mean, if you went to the bar, it was polite to say, you know, half a lager and lime, half a lager and black, and that was it. You know, there was no fancy drinks because there was no money. And there he was, and everyone was like, who's this guy? And there was a driver outside, who's this guy? And then we realised who he was, and I just looked and thought, I'm pretty sure he's not paying for any of this. I'm pretty sure that either Liverpool City Council or Knowsley Council, because he was on secondment from them, was paying for it. And that's when I just saw, I mean, the hypocrisy was just unbelievable. And it was real. And it was real. And actually, they ran the city to the ground. And, you know, when that happens and you watch it happen and you just see people on the other end of that, it was the same with the unions, you know, the car factory eventually closed, and you just see people's, the life impacts that has. So it does make you think about it. And yeah, that's when I became more conservative. And I voted Conservative from the first election from the age of 19.
And I mentioned in the introduction your academic achievements in your comp. Am I right to say you're the only people to get 10 O-levels? And does that suggest you were ambitious as a child?
No, it's actually quite astonishing. So you only ever took 6 or 7. 7, I think, was the maximum. But what had happened at school was, you know, in the 80s, and the sort of girls and the boys' gyms and PE were at different times. And what that meant is when it came to some of your options, you had to choose the girls' subjects, which were sewing and cookery. And the guys got to do engineering and technical drawing and woodwork. Well, I wasn't happy with this situation. So my mum went up to school and said, you know, she wants to do these other subjects. She wants to do technical drawing and engineering. Anyway, the grand result of all of that was that I ended up doing all of them. So I had to stay after school till 5:30 because she'd made a huge point of winning this big battle, which effectively meant I had to stay in school till 5:30. A poor teacher who was fabulous, Mr. Ashcroft, who was the guy who really inspired me in school and really thought I could make something of myself. And, you know, he stayed behind and I did all those subjects. And that's how I ended up doing 10. I wasn't even the most surprised people when I got my O-level results. I was one of the last years to do O-levels, was every single one of my teachers. And me. I mean, nobody could believe it, really. I wasn't sort of the girly swat. I wasn't even top of the class.
And did you have any early ambitions as a child, you know, in terms of what you wanted to be? Because we had various ones come up on this podcast. Going back to coffee, she wanted to be a mechanic nun. What were you thinking around that time? Or perhaps when you were surprised by your own grades?
Well, by that time, so I'd started work at 13. I'd started as a Saturday girl in a shop. And actually, I didn't get my grades. My sister phoned me up and she'd kind of gone and got them and phoned me up and kind of went silent and said, oh my God, I can't believe you've got them all. And we were, you know, sort of checking whether that was true. It couldn't possibly be true. Before that, so I'd been working in a shop on a Saturday. I kind of thought maybe a hairdresser. I've always liked fiddling with my hair, but I hadn't really had any sort of serious thoughts. And then it was actually my maths teacher who said, have you ever thought of doing an apprenticeship? There wasn't really. So the school I went to, they closed all the comprehensive schools in Knowsley. And, you know, and I went for the full 5 years, and there wasn't really much. You could have stayed on in sixth form. You know, they might have been able to squeeze an A-level or two out, but there was virtually nobody did, and virtually nobody got anywhere, and the chance of going to a decent university was zero. So this
just in terms of like how many people they let in at that time,
nobody passed. Nobody, if you didn't get in, I mean, less than 10% of the kids got 5 GCSEs or O levels as they were at the time. So if you haven't got, you know, the people getting the O levels to get onto A levels, then, you know, there was just a cycle. And they closed all the sixth forms down a couple of years later. They were gone for good. So, and there was a new college, Carmel, which, funnily enough, I speak to the principal now in my new job, but that was a bit delayed. It wasn't open. So there wasn't that many options. And my teacher just said, you know, apply for an apprenticeship, and if you get a good apprenticeship, they'll basically take your studies further. So I did, and I got a really fantastic one, actually. It was with General Motors. It was with a sub-assembly factory in Kirby. And it's what would now be called a rotational degree level apprenticeship. It never had anything like that name. It was just an apprenticeship in a car factory. You clocked
now
in.
Now a new skill, you can label it.
I can label it. I can label it, and it sounds so much more impressive. But it basically, it was up to you, really. There was 5 of us. There were 4 guys and me, so I was the token. They had to have one woman, so every year there was one, so I was that one, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was, I mean, 2,500 people worked in the car factory. You know, you clocked on, you know, the smell of metal, you walk through the car factory every day, and it was, you couldn't recreate the learning experience. It was so good. And then I just went around the whole factory learning pretty much everything, how the whole business works, as well as going one day a week to study up to degree level.
Yeah, and you went on, as you mentioned, to obviously study business studies at university. Did you get much of a university experience?
No, I went one day a week and a Wednesday evening. I didn't know anyone. I have no friends from university. I've got friends from...
Wasn't it like a freshers week then or...
You were working full time. Yeah. The degree was shoved on, right? So I used to get Fridays off and I used to also have to go on Wednesday evenings after work. And then I did my homework at the weekend and yeah, and that was it basically. You know, I did my dissertation on the replacement car market in Europe. It was actually implemented and it was used because it was real because I was seeing these business problems. So
do you think approaching it in that way meant that you perhaps were more focused on using a degree to kind of further your career than perhaps some people are who go to university? Because on this podcast, more generally, lots of people see it more adolescence and experience that goes, I think perhaps compared to other countries like Germany, where people often live at home while going to university, it's almost seen here as kind of a romantic coming of age experience.
Yeah, no, I didn't have the romantic coming of age experience. Yeah. To be honest, none of my friends did. Nobody, yeah. Nobody around me did. Nobody in my family did. Nobody at my school did. And it was a coming of age experience that happened for other people. Let's just say our coming of age experience was get a job, earn some money, pay some keep. So we had to pay. Yeah. I mean, as soon as I started work, all of us, you know, we started to pay, you know, some money to our parents to help out. So it was a completely different rite of passage. But I wouldn't say, I mean, I enjoyed it thoroughly. Yeah. And we still had great fun. I mean, you're growing up in Liverpool, you can't not have fun.
Is it funny hearing some of your Conservative MP colleagues talk about their university days? Just because it does feel like chalk and cheese.
It's a different experience. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like I used to read Mallory Towers. Yeah. And I went to a comprehensive school in Knowsley, right? They were very different experiences. I could appreciate one from the book. And I used to think, oh, I'd love to play lacrosse. I didn't really know what lacrosse was, but it sounded cool. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very different experience. And the thing is, you only get your own experience. You can't basically be someone else or get someone else's opportunity.
Now, I want to talk about your career before politics, because again, perhaps chalk and cheese, we have, I suppose, a stereotype sometimes of some paths to becoming an MP, which is obviously going to Oxbridge, being a special advisor for a few years and then moving into a seat. But you're in a group, which lots of people say they want to see more of, which is having actually a very long, successful career out of politics before going there. It's almost, I suppose you could call it your second career. So in terms of your business career, Amadeus, other parts, some I mentioned in the introduction, I wondered if you could give us a, you know, highlight role of, you know, what you were doing and what you learned along the way.
So obviously the apprenticeship, you got to learn everything. And that gave them the opportunity to see what you were good at and what you liked. And they basically said to me, look, you've got a really good personality. You're a very good communicator. You should do something commercial. You've got a head for figures as well. So, you know, we see you more as an outward facing person as opposed to someone in the back room designing the car part or whatever. And that was career's advice of a kind, I guess, but it was actually good. And they did know me quite well. So I started as a buyer, buying the pieces for cars, which was actually a highly stressful job because they just introduced just in time. So effectively everything had to arrive at once, otherwise they didn't make the car. That was a lot of expense with no car. So it was super stressful because they couldn't arrive too early and they couldn't arrive too late. So that was that experience, and that was, you know, what I learned there. I then went on through the procurement route to become IT procurement manager for NatWest Bank, one of them. So that was that. And then I was highly commercial. I then ended up bizarrely in Tokyo, which was basically trying to get digital payments sourced. So, you know, it was at the time, it was in the 90s, there was lots of things happening, the internet was coming, mobile phones were coming. And then after that,
Did you learn Japanese when you were in Tokyo?
I tried. Oh, this is so funny, because I went to Harlow College to try to learn Japanese. And I spent 6 months trying to do this. And I thought, you know, I could spend the rest of my life trying to do this and never sound any better than an 18-month-year-old. But it did actually make me think I wanted to learn a second language. And I loved Japan. I loved spending that time in Tokyo. But the next job opportunity I did get was when I went to Madrid to work with Amadeus. I was there for 8 years and I did learn to speak Spanish. So I suppose that started that journey. And then I kind of moved into sales, so that I ended up leading global customer sales. It was a very international business. It was a great company, which is where I ended up getting a lot of financial security. So I'd worked a lot. I'd gone up the ranks as such. But the IPO gave me financial security. And it was then that I thought, you know what, I just feel like I've missed out and I want to go back full time. And that's when I went to London Business School in 2010 and did the full time experience. But I still didn't go for the sort of, you know, going away, Oxford Towers or whatever. Not that I would have gone in. It was super practical. You know, how do I get to learn all about data and digital? And, you know, the whole world's changed in terms of technology. So, you know, that's what I did. And I did, after then, intend to do something different. But then I got pulled back into the corporate world because basically they throw money at you and offer you jobs. And it's hard to resist that. So, yeah, I did go back in the corporate world for a couple of years. But then I thought, you know, I'd already started to think about a second career. I thought, I definitely want to do something different. The great thing about starting at 16 is you're young enough to be able to do, you know, nearly 30 years in one career. And I don't know how long I'll do in this one, but you do actually have the time because you start young.
Now, talk us through the process in which you decide to try and become an MP. And Jenkin, does she play an important role in that?
Yeah, she was absolutely... I didn't know this woman, right? So I'd gone to the theatre, which was quite unusual in itself because my husband also had an international business career. So the chance of us both being in London in the week and the theatre and having tickets was really super low. So we'd got organised. I think I'd bought these tickets for his birthday and we went anyway. And during the interval, we met somebody that we both knew who was actually worked in the Japanese business world. And he was with her and they both knew each other because their kids went to school. And I think the reason they were together was I think Anne had bought the tickets and I think Bernard couldn't go. And she'd invited this family friend. And we met in the interval. And during that 15 minutes, I mean, she's a fast worker, Baroness Anne Jenkin, I must say. But during that 15 minutes, she'd said to me, "Have you ever thought of being an MP?" And I said, "No, that's completely random. Why would anybody wake up in the morning as a business person and think, you know what, I'm going to be an MP?" And so she said, "Come for a cup of tea in the House of Lords," which obviously is a very easy invitation to say yes to. I've never been to the House of Lords. It's like, whack. I mean, you suddenly feel like you've already arrived. I'm going to the House of Lords for tea. So I went to the House of Lords for tea. Having said that many times, it sounds so good to House of Lords for tea. So I went there and, you know, I had a long conversation and she basically said, you know, "We're looking for more women. We're looking for more women who have different backgrounds and business backgrounds in particular. And, you know, your background, you know, coming from Liverpool and obviously being a natural conservative in a way, you know, nobody had told me, well, in fact, the opposite. Everyone had told me not to be a conservative. So I'd naturally come to the party." So I just built on it from there. But of course, you know politics better than I do. Once you think about, okay, this sounds like an interesting thing to do. I've always been curious. So, you know, I'm like, okay, let's see what's in, you know, open, what's behind that door. Then I had to sort of start at the bottom, really. I had to start at the bottom. And I think that's one of the things that might put a lot of people off. You know, you've got these big business careers. By that time, you've got lots of people working for you. You've got the office with the, you know, the swingy chair and, you know, the views and whatever, and the cash. And you suddenly start again. And you start again not knowing if it's going to go anywhere because it's a random process getting selected in politics. So it's really a bit of a leap of faith. So I can see why a lot of people wouldn't do it. You've got to be in that mindset, which is, you know, I've done this for a long time. I'm going to have a shot at something else. But it's not an easy path because it's much easier to stay in the corporate world and carry on doing the next job and get the next pip up. But, you know, life's too short in some ways to do the same thing for a long time.
And at that point, were you a card-carrying Conservative Party member or...?
Yes, I had joined the party and I joined the party in 98 and that's obviously after we lost very heavily. And I guess what really drove me to really join the party is we were living at that point, it's actually Jeremy Hunt's constituency now, it was Virginia Bottomley, and she'd nearly lost that seat, which was a very safe Conservative seat. And I thought, my goodness, you know, this has really been, you know, quite a catastrophic event, and, you know, maybe I should do a little bit more to help. I didn't do very much to help because that was just before I then got a job in Madrid and whizzed off there. So, I joined the party, I donated, you know, to the various raffles or whatever, but I didn't get involved, as it were, because I was still, you know, taking 100 flights a year in an international business career, so it wasn't really possible. But I did, you know, join.
Now, you contested St. Helens, South and Worcester in 2015. What was that like, campaigning? And what's the process like getting it to stand in a seat like that?
Well, it was fantastic because it enabled me to go back and live with mum and dad for a bit. So I went right back to my childhood home, you know, staring at the same Artex ceiling that I'd stared at for pretty much all my life. And, you know, you always have this feeling when you're sort of, you know, you don't really start with very much. And you always think, you know, I'll give it a go. You know, the worst thing that can happen is I end up back in my old bedroom, which is, of course, course, where I'd suddenly ended up. There I was in my 40s thinking Jesus a little bit too literal.
Put some new posters up.
Yeah, exactly. Get rid of Jackie. So that was lovely. Now, for my parents, it was a little bit of a shock. They could not believe, you know, they were so proud of the business career that I built and, you know, the spoils of that as well. And they couldn't believe that you'd finally got yourself to a point where you were, you know, earning good money and, you know, financially secure. And then you'd kind of give it up. So they couldn't believe that. Then they were a bit fearful, you know, there are, you know, politics had changed, you know, even when I was younger, you could say you were a conservative and people would just be like, that's weird. But no one would think you were a horrible person or be nasty, or there was no identity politics. Nobody sort of painted themselves as a martyr by their, you know, political, or a good or a bad person by their political party or who they vote for. But that had kind of changed. And so they were a bit fearful. So I actually changed my name. I kept my maiden name up until that point, all the way through my career. And I changed my name to my husband's name because my dad looked so worried. He was like, really, you know, does this job come with insurance? And so he was worried. So I had to kind of take them along the journey because they couldn't understand it. People said it was going to be really tough because, of course, they don't really normally vote Conservatives in Merseyside. Actually, people are still people, and you know, I was finding they were still friendly. You know, they'd say, oh, you know, no, we're not going to vote for you or whatever, but they weren't nasty at all. Only the activists and some of the sort of people who are activists are kind of nasty, but on the whole, people are just lovely. So I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed being back home. I knew I wasn't going to win. And, you know, I got to know Connor and Mary, actually the two Labour MPs who won their seats in that election. And it was a great experience. It's when you know if you want to do it. It's when you know. And there's certain moments, there's your face on a leaflet. That's kind of a big thing, giving it to people. It's like offering a part of yourself. Seeing your face on posters with things drawn all over them. That's a thing. Can you do that or not? Doing hustings where people might be shouting or whatever. You know, is that how you want to spend your time? Is that how you want to spend your life? And they're really important. You have to test yourself in politics because there's a lot of tests that you get, and you know, there's no point doing all of that and then giving up.
And you end that election, as you say, you don't win your seat, but it wasn't as though there was a big expectation that you would. And you, in that process, have decided you definitely want to be an MP.
Yeah. I came second for the first time. I was very proud. I mean, a country mile behind the first place. But yeah, I decided I did. And more than that, I thought maybe I could, because, you know, I didn't, you know, I'm not super confident. I'm not one of these people like, you know, the world's been waiting for me. Like, you know, here I am. I'm just, you know, I have to build my confidence in a much slower, more normal way. And so I had to just do that and see whether I thought I could do it. I'm still like that now. You know, the thing about politics is you spend too much of your time out over your skis thinking, oh my God, now I've got to go on the telly and now I've got to go and do, you know, question time, or now I've got to go and do this. It's always something that's, for me, something I've never done before and something that feels like another mountain to climb every day. But that really does inspire you as well. It keeps you stimulated, let's say.
Now, you win your seat and you enter Parliament, but it's not quite the huge new intake that was predicted, because actually the election ends up being a bit of a disaster for Theresa May. You know, the Tory party hold on, but they have to do a pact for the DUP. What was it like entering Parliament at that point? You know, it's a strange time to arrive, really.
It was. It was bewildering, actually. I think the whole thing was bewildering. And the upside is we're quite a close intake for 2017. There's not that many of us. We're quite
traumatized intake.
Well, we know each other. We used to book a room in the, you know, for a meal, and we'd all just about be able to squeeze around the table, you know, big table. But you know, so that's good. So I think in terms of the friendships, and you know, we all kind of joined at the same time. So that's positive. But actual Parliament, I mean, I don't think even people who'd been there for decades could keep up with what was going on. It was quite an extraordinary time. Obviously, we'd had this sort of monumentous referendum with the results to leave the European Union. And then we had to try and do it in some way, shape or form. And then we had to try and do it in a hung Parliament and all of those things together, which obviously proved to be just too much, actually. It's just, and I suppose if you're thinking about it now, I suppose it was always obvious that it was going to be too much, because hung parliaments bring opportunism and, you know, all sorts of people's views then become more apparent. So, Yeah, it was. But for me, it was like a crash course. I felt like it was an intensive course. And I learned an awful lot. I mean, you know, we even went through a leadership contest. We went through votes of confidence and all kinds of things, which are really rare events. But, you know, we got them all.
Now, I want to talk about that leadership contest. But just before we do, on Brexit, we are now reaching a point where, you know, it's crunch Brexit talks again. But it does feel a lot of the drama's gone out of it in the sense of the drama during the Theresa May years. Because back then it wasn't just a drama between the UK and the EU. It was about the parliamentary party, yeah. You know, the fact that arithmetic didn't really work for maybe any type of Brexit.
Yeah, that's true.
But you, I think, were, you know, someone who supported Theresa May's Brexit deal. And I seem to remember that you were one of the people brave enough to go out on broadcast and say what you did. Did that give you a good expertise in, I suppose, broadcast for a politician? Because, I mean, I think it was quite a difficult gig at the time.
Well, you know what? It's really funny. So I get to the withdrawal agreement and I spent the whole weekend reading it. It was 597 pages in the first version of it. I then made my husband read it so that we could discuss it. And, you know, so
was he grateful for that?
Well, he is now because he can talk about it in great detail. But, you know, so we could talk about it, but we were both talking about it from a perspective of international business. So we understood how international business works. We understood how it worked with the European Union, how it worked in countries with other countries. So from that perspective, and I remember, I'll never forget, I went back in on the, you know, into Parliament on the Monday, and I was chatting to a few people and I said, I was actually quite relieved when I read this agreement. I thought it's a sensible, you know, if you give somebody the task, which is, you know, exiting the European Union after 45 years without breaking up, you know, creating too much risk for jobs or whatever. If that's what you want to achieve, then this is kind of the way to do it. But of course, that's not how it worked out. And I realised...
What was their reaction when you said that to people?
Well, they were saying, no, we don't like this. And when I was trying to probe it, because I had actually read it, I realised that perhaps maybe they'd just already decided they didn't like it or something like this. So I realised there was a completely different sort of parallel universe where all this was going on. Again, a learning experience. I'm quite literal and quite pragmatic. But I then realised that I was doing something that other people were not.
Trying to
figure out how it was going to work and, you know, really looking into the customs arrangements and stuff like that. So... But that was, I guess, probably my experience of sort of by that point, nearly 30 years in business and about 2 years in politics.
Now, I want to talk about Rory Stewart, because in that leadership contest that followed, I mean, you're talking about being a pragmatist. And I think what was quite refreshing was in that Tory leadership contest, you clearly had Boris Johnson, who I don't think was always seen as a favourite, to be fair, given the fact that people weren't sure we'd have parliamentary support. But I think it's fair to say that if Boris Johnson wasn't always the favourite, Rory Stewart was never the favourite. He was outside bet. He had a campaign that was very pro the deal. And he, I want to say grassroots campaign, but I don't know what would describe it as, but it just quickly sprung up. It gathered momentum. And before you knew it, he was going much further than lots of people who I think people thought would be doing better. So, and you were one of his first backers, I believe. Why did you back Rory Stewart? And did your colleagues laugh at you in the beginning?
Yes, in answer to the second question. So firstly, I went and sat down with every single leadership contestant and asked them lots of questions and genuinely was open-minded. I didn't know any of them, to be honest. I knew Boris was going to win. It was obvious Boris was going to win. I think by the time I sat down and had my conversation with Boris, I think there was 160 Conservative MPs who had backed him. And so I said to him, well, you know, what's the point of me being 161 at first? And it was, you know, the dying in the ditch thing. And I was very honest with him. I said, look, you know, I understand why you have to do this and I understand why it fits for you, but I've got a reputation as someone who actually understands business. So dying in a ditch isn't that sort of attractive for me. So it's going to make me look like I don't know what I'm doing or don't know what I'm talking about. And actually my business reputation is important to me because it's real and it is a differentiator in politics. So I wasn't willing to do the no deal dying in a ditch, which is where that made that backing that difficult. And then I just looked at all the others. And it was when we came to some of the hustings, and I'm pretty clear that to actually be Prime Minister of this country, you've got to be a really good communicator. We've had poor communicators and it doesn't work that well. I just think you need to be able to communicate and just get, you know, get to the British people. And when I looked at them all, I just thought that actually Boris and Rory were the standout communicators. Both of them were excellent communicators. I mean, I knew Rory wasn't going to win, but I thought he'll show a side to our party and he'll be able to communicate well and he'll be able to show balance to our party as well. So, you know, he's worth being in the contest. So, but I knew he wasn't going to win. And of course, everyone says to you, oh, you know, this is a big mistake. You know, you have to back Boris, otherwise you'll never get a job. And I thought, well, I've had loads of jobs, you know. If I don't get this next one, then I'll get, you know, I'll get somewhere in life. So it's not.
I'll be all right.
Yeah, you know, I'm 52. It's not. It's, I don't have the same desire, you know, that maybe I would if I was 32.
Yeah. Have you got any particular highlights from that Rory Stewart campaign? I have flashbacks to like standing in various outdoor venues in London.
There was the circus tent where he did the launch, and there was all these kind of trapeze and everything around. What was astonishing is, there was hundreds and hundreds of people in the venue. There was hundreds of people outside of the venue. And then there was 6,000 people live streaming it. I'm thinking 6,000 people are live streaming a Conservative launch event for a leadership. That, of course, is, you know, incredibly difficult to see how he could win, particularly if he got to even to the members, because that was going to be his biggest challenge. So
it was fun, though.
It was different.
Everyone seemed to be doing because they genuinely wanted to do it, and there was a lot of people just like, you know, fuck it. Ultimately, we'll just do something. We'll do something we actually want to do and see what happens.
And there was something, you know, I didn't believe that he was going to be leader. I didn't think that was possible, but I did believe that he had something to say, and I liked his communication style. I liked his style of communicating as well, and I just thought he broadened the appeal of the Conservative Party, particularly amongst young people. Young people loved him. And actually, I still go around Chichester now and people say to me, oh, you know, oh, well, you're all right. You backed Rory Stewart, you know. So for some people, it worked. And particularly for younger people, it worked.
Now, I want to move, obviously, to the present day. Now, you had various PPS roles, but your current role is, as we say, in the Department of Education on apprenticeships. Now, when you were offered it, what was the conversation that happened? Do you think the fact that you're probably in the minority in the Tory parliamentary party has actually done an apprenticeship?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of semi-pitched for the role, I think. You know, that you have these sort of open sort of discussions about, you know, what where you see yourself, what kind of things. And of course, you know, there's a lot of things that I could contribute to. Obviously, business, international, trade, digital. I've worked in technology for a long time. I probably understand tech more than most. But I said, you know, if it was me making the decision, then I would put me in the apprenticeships and skills minister job, because I'm the living, walking, talking, breathing. I'm exactly what, you know, an apprenticeship offers in terms of life chances, social mobility, careers. It worked for me. I can be a great advert for it. I really passionately believe in them because obviously I did one. I think they're the best kept secret in this country. I mean, we were talking earlier about why do people still go and get all this debt for degrees when actually you can do a degree apprenticeship or you can do a higher level apprenticeship for free and get paid. So I really believe in them. But I also think, and this is something in my DNA, having gone to a Knowsley comprehensive school for all of the 5 years that I was at school, senior school, I know in my DNA that the people I was there with are as bright as anyone I've met ever since. Even if the people I've met ever since have got much better qualifications. And there's a conversation in the DfE, you know, people are level zeros, ones, twos or whatever. And it's basically your qualification level. And then they have different policies for different levels. But they're quite patronising some of the policies at the bottom level because it's as though really you just can't do it. And I think, well, actually most people can do it. They just didn't have a good experience at school. Or they, you know, they went to school years ago and, you know, they lost, you know, those opportunities. Or, you know, lots of people have very complex lives and difficult things are going on. So, but I know in my DNA that they are as bright and therefore they can do whatever they want. And you know, in future years, they'll have opportunities. If you can give them the opportunity, they will go somewhere. You know, my best friend, she left school with one GCSE, well, CSE, the CSE bit. She didn't do the GCE bit. So CSE, one. And the other one left with zero. And I got 10, right? So that was us. And, you know, she's now got a degree and two masters, you know. And she came, you know, the local council estate. Her mum worked in the same factory my nan did, Huntley and Palmer's. Her dad was a tradesman, electrician, I think. And, you know, that was it. But now she, you know, she runs a cancer hospital. from the, she sat next, you know, well, she didn't actually sit next to me. She was in, you know, the lower classes even. So, you know, I know that. I know that. I go back to school reunions. I see some terrible stories of people whose lives haven't worked out, but just also people who've basically found their way on in life. So I in my DNA, I believe that.
Yeah. And is it your boss? I don't know. The education secretary, Gavin Williamson, also went to a state school.
He did.
And we're speaking after quite a tumultuous few days for the Conservative Party with the departure of Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson's director of comms, Lee Kane. And there's much to discuss there, but I just wondered, one of the things we were talking about just before we started recording was with Lee Kane going, also a state school, but he once dressed as a chicken back when he worked, did shifts at the Mirror. He was the Mirror chicken that went and tried to scare politicians when they didn't do debates. And it's been quite interesting, I think, in the past week or so, because some of the anonymous quotes, you know, saying, oh, well, this person was never cut out to be a director of comms because, you know, they were a former chicken. There's almost a little bit of snobbery in it. What do you think about all that?
I mean, you know what? You do what you have to do, right? I can imagine. I don't know what would happen if someone said to me, right, you know, today you've got to dress as a chicken and follow this guy around. In a way, I suppose. I don't know Lee Kane. I would imagine he probably found it funny. I'd find it quite funny. I'd think, you know what? This is actually quite funny. It's quite clever. It's very easy for other people to, you know, to have views. But, you know, I think it's the rise of the working class comprehensive school kids in Conservative, isn't it? You know, I'm very happy with that position. I'm very happy being one of those groups. And I do think there's many of us. That's actually a big change in the 2019 general election. There's a lot of working class Conservatives who went to comprehensive schools, which, by the way, is what 93% of the population does. It is normal. It is so normal. Yeah. It's more normal than anything else. You know, so I think that we just need to remember that.
And now just a few very quick final things before we end the podcast. One is, I mentioned, obviously, change in the party. There's lots of speculation at the moment about what direction the Tory party will go in, you know, with some change at the top. A Boris Johnson reset. I think there's also Downing Street saying nothing will change, but some people think something will change. So it's great to report on. But I wondered, what's in your view, you know, how much of a broad church should the Tory party be? Do you think it should be very focused on the red wall? Or do you think there's scope, because there's a debate at the moment, about how much environment you can do, is there scope to actually kind of reach out to, I suppose, Lib Dem type Tory voters at the same time as Red Bull voters? Do we need to confine ourselves?
So I keep reading articles on this, which I never studied political philosophy, so I'm kind of in awe of it in a way that I kind of sort of glad I'm not one. So I kind of look at it and think, so for me, I've always been quite... Even when I grew up in Knowsley, the values of the people that I grew up with and my family are the conservative values. I always used to say if there was a blind test and you just looked at policies and things, you would probably get more of them choosing conservative. But the Conservative Party brand has obviously been sort of hijacked by the left. And certainly that's still the case in Liverpool. What happened at the last election is something I've always thought, which is, if you know, the sort of pragmatic sort of northerners who look at it and think, actually, this sort of chimes with my views. Now, of course, a lot of that was... the catalyst for that was Brexit. But there are other things as well. Skills and apprenticeships are something that, you know, absolutely transcends every single one of those groups that you said. Skills are the answer to all of it. And, you know, everybody thinks that skills and apprenticeships are important, even if they don't think their own kids should do one. When they look themselves in the bathroom mirror, they have to admit that to themselves. They do. That's just because of their own sort of, you know, life journeys. Now, obviously, tone, language and those kind of things and how the party presents itself, well, that can differ at times. And that was quite stark in the last election with Brexit and Get Brexit Done, which was a divisive election. But that now is gone. And I know that most people, even if they voted Remain, I voted Remain, you know, accepted from the get-go, actually, that we should leave, that, you know, we have had a vote and we're Democrats and we ought to do it. So I think most people were in that frame of mind. Coronavirus has clearly got the agenda. You know, anyone who thinks we'll do this, we'll do that, etc. We are actually really, you know, trying to manage the unmanageable with a sort of highly infectious virus that can kill certain parts of the population, that a huge amount of the population seem to be asymptomatic. And, you know, we're trying to manage the unmanageable in a way. Now, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of things that have had to happen there, but I feel like we're if we can get, you know, we're sat here today, we've got the second vaccine. It looks like it's 95% viable in terms of accuracy. It looks like we're going to have vaccines. It looks like mass testing is going to become more of a tool that we can use to allow people to see their loved ones in care homes, or to allow people to go into venues and to try and get some normality. Won't be completely normal for a while, but to get some normality back as we go into the next year. If that is the case, then really the agenda becomes much more about the levelling up. And levelling up, to me, is, you know, is the number one thing. And it is levelling up that opportunity. It is the kid, the one that sat there, like I was in a Knowsley Comprehensive School today, you know, making sure that she has the opportunities that I had, making sure that most of them have the opportunities, not just one, you know, the one in 10, you know, that more people have those opportunities. And I believe that that's something, you know, that everybody could get behind. Everybody in our party would get behind that. I'm a big, you know, I absolutely support that we need to focus on the green agenda. There's no doubt with COP26 next year that that will happen. So, you know, there's a lot of initiatives in that area, and I think everyone can get behind that. So I believe those two things will be able to drive a lot of unity within the party. I hope so, anyway.
Fingers crossed. And then final question is when we ask everyone on this podcast, which is just, what is the worst advice you've ever been given?
Well, it was my best mate from school, Jackie, who basically, I had long hair and I hadn't done much with it. And she basically told me I was boring and, you know, I was never going to get a boyfriend. And, you know, what I needed to do was, and the place she advised me to go was my nan's hairdresser. And actually they used, for the perm I had, they used the same rollers with the diameter of a pencil. And I tell you that it took 3 years of my social life was gone just there, just there. I mean, it was the most unbelievably bad perm. 3.5 years later, people were congratulating me and saying how lovely it was, and I'd had it 3.5 years before. So it was just, it took out a whole portion of my life. She was supposed to come with me to give me advice and guidance, but let's just say didn't wake up in time. So that's probably the worst advice that I've ever been given, and she knows it, and she always argues that I got the time wrong and she would have been there to save me from this disastrous I mean, it completely changed my life. I think I put on about 40 years in one day. So that was the worst advice. And probably the one that I ignored was the one where they said to me, you know, not to go to London Business School. Don't take a year off. You're right on the, you know, you're going to get to the top. Don't do it. And of course, my life's changed massively from that, because I now find myself in a completely different career. So that's probably the best of the advice that I best ignored, because I love what I'm doing now and I love where I am in life.
Thank you, Gillian. And thank you for listening.
The Spectator is having a flash sale. Get 12 issues of the magazine for just £12, in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Whiskey, completely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale. Be quick, the offer ends on Monday.